Thanks for staying with us tonight, everyone. We're talking about the health of our oceans, sustainable seafood, with Chef Rick Moonen. Rick, I want to talk about your book for a second. We've mentioned a little bit about what's in it. Make the pitch about why people should buy this thing and what's in it in terms of something you could use at home regarding seafood.
Well, this isn't a preachy book about sustainability. It's interwoven in small ways. What I set out to do is to diminish or help eliminate all the fears surrounding cooking fish at home. It's really not that difficult, and I realized early on in my career that there weren't that many books about seafood cooking at home. There was the very 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 high end, super fancy French guides to cooking seafood, but it was something you would never do at home. You know, poaching an entire turbo and putting a hollandaise sauce and glazing it under a broiler. You know, it's not happening at home. Two bad casseroles. So I tried to put myself in a situation that I heard the most concern about. So I created the recipes for fish without a doubt on a small four-burner stove in a New York City apartment, buying seafood at the supermarket, just as most people need to do. And I came up with recipes that have results that are much more successful than have been experienced in most home situations. And, there's except substitutes in every one of the recipes. So if you're going out for let's say you're going for mackerel. Well, okay, you're not going to find mackerel. Maybe you can use a bluefish or a different oily fish, sardines, rouget. You know, there's a list of other things that you can substitute in that recipe so that you don't. So there's really more than 250 recipes in the book. I don't know what the matrix would be, but it's a lot more than that if you calculate all the substitutes that you can make. And I'm asking you and encouraging you to make those substitutes. Broke it down by cooking style: salads, grilling, roasting, frying, and searing, and then cooking on top of the stove. And I think I accomplished with this book. I feel comfortable and happy about the fact that these recipes actually work at home, and you can select fish no matter where you live in the United States. As a matter of fact, Gourmet Magazine gave it their first Cookbook Club sticker selection. You know, this was their inaugural when they started up with their Cookbook Club. This was the first book to get a sticker.
Well, I'll tell you about another first, Rick. Is that I think this is probably the first cookbook that's ever been discussed on Coast to Coast. We normally cover different kind of topics, but I think the audience is probably pretty interested in this.
Oh, okay, well, I appreciate the opportunity.
Tell me about shrimp. You had mentioned the top three, the big ones: salmon and tuna and shrimp. Am I supposed to stop eating shrimp?
No, you don't necessarily need to stop eating shrimp. Again, I go back to the United States, but it's the truth. There's some farmed shrimp in the United States, and it's not as detrimental to the environment as most other underdeveloped country produced shrimp products, which comprises most of what we eat, unfortunately. So it's kind of difficult to source out a really good shrimp source, and I guarantee you're going to get a blank stare when you start asking people where that shrimp's from, because most people don't even know that. I'm talking about operators of restaurants. Okay, but as a consumer purchasing for yourself to eat at your home, you're cooking, you're boiling up some when you get home, or you're grilling them, you're following a recipe out of fish without a doubt, because of course you're going to run out and get that. You really would like to focus on the Gulf of Mexico. There's Alaska is a really good and sustainable model for fisheries, as is the Gulf of Mexico is to their farmed shrimp. Now, dredging and is still taking place in certain areas, but less and less. There's a lot more. There's the concerns that surround the shrimp farming and harvesting practices are a lot less severe in the Gulf of Mexico. I guess that's the most succinct way that I can put it.
Okay, we're going to we need to get a break out of the way, and then we're going to the phone. Stay with us with your questions for Chef Rick Moonen here on Coast to Coast AM. We are talking with Chef Rick Moonen, author of the book Fish Without a Doubt, about sustainable seafood. Going to the phones, west of the Rockies, Chuck in Fairbanks, Alaska. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight? Hey, I share your passion for the Yukon king salmon. Boy, that is just some delicious. My Four of my adopted daughters are from down in the lower Yukon, and every year I get a case of, I didn't this year because of the poor fishery, I get a case of canned smoked salmon strips, and it's just a delight.
That's a pity, isn't it? I mean, that's the best fish I ever ate in my life.
It is.
When I first touched it, it was amazing.
We just heard in today's paper, the chum salmon had a complete collapse, but I don't want people to misunderstand because we had a record run of reds in Bristol Bay this year, and it's that Yukon King. I think that this year it might have been, we had an El Nino year, and usually that's not very good fishery. But we go down to the Copper River and dip the red salmon. As a state resident, you can dip 30 salmon. Usually if they're running good, they're about, takes you, you know, 3 or 4 hours, and they're just delicious. I think one thing is really important is how you take care of the fish once you catch them. And I don't know if you have any input in that with the stuff you get. But how do you cook? I don't know if you can answer this. How do you like to cook those oily salmon fish, salmon we have up here, that in a way that, you know, brings out the flavor the best in it?
Well, you can slow roast them.
Okay.
You can pan sear them. Basically, you don't. It's like cooking a piece of foie gras.
Yeah.
That fish is so full of salmon. I mean, so salmon flavored, so full of fat. I mean, we cooked them when I was in Emonic, we cooked them on a barbecue, but I had to keep that fish so far away from the heat source. It had to be indirect heat because the fat that would drip out of it was just crazy. And it would come out, it would just melt in your mouth. It was like tasting mushrooms and fish at the same time. It was the umami, if you know what that is. It's like your mouth would just start watering and it wouldn't stop. It's one of God's gifts to man. It truly, truly is. And the Yupiks, Eskimos that live there for so long, don't even realize that there's a different fish available. That's the only thing they know. You know, and that's what blows my mind. It's not hardly even enough for them now for their subsistence. And, you know, they have first crack at it.
Rick, Chuck was mentioning that a couple of salmon species seem to be doing well, others are not. I mean, how would one do well and the other one not? What's different?
You know, it's a great question, and I do not have a direct answer to that. Talking about the reds. You mean the sockeyes, right? That's what we call sockeye salmon.
Chuck, are you still there?
No, I guess
okay,
not.
Okay, Chuck's gone. Okay. Well,
but for some reason, the Chinook or the king salmon, maybe they go out deeper into the ocean. They're a bigger, mightier, stronger fish. There's got to be different, like, regions of the ocean that they frequent. And perhaps the reds or the sockeye salmon that have had a pretty decent year this year. And when you say decent, if you start looking at the numbers, I can guarantee that the word decent is being stretched a little bit here.
Because they're all going down.
Absolutely. We have to be careful. I mean, for the first time, I don't know how many years, was it 2 years now, or maybe it's into its third year, that off the coast of Oregon and California, all wild salmon is shut down completely, 100%. And I remember reading a newspaper. I was in Walla Walla, Washington, the day that was announced. And it was front page news, you know, it was headline. And there was a farmer, it was a fisherman, excuse me, who was quoted in the extra large quoting in the center of the whole full page article. He said basically he equates going after the wild salmon from here on out would be like a farmer eating his grain before it was even planted, the seeds. And I was like, whoa, that's how they're perceiving it. And these are the people that make a living off of fishing, saying that it's time that they're throwing in the towel on it. And that just goes to show you it's within our reach. It's in our hands. It's no longer a discussion. It's a call to arms. There's a delicious way to go about it. You know, and all you need to do is follow some simple seafood watch cards and be a little bit more sensitive about how you consume, and it'll speak volumes. And that's because it's so far that's historically what has worked.
You know, you hear about taking care of the ocean and sustainability and saving species, and we're so politically divided in this country now, and people are angry at each other on both sides. I think there's a concern that maybe it's perceived as, well, it must be, if we're trying to save fish, it must be some liberal, pinko, environmental cause of the week kind of a thing.
Yeah, well, now it's starting to really ring true in a lot of people's ears, because you just can't get what you used to be able to get. You know, you go to the Chesapeake area, you know, the amount of blue crab that used to be able to just like, it seems like endless. Now it's a delicacy. You know,
first time caller, James in Montana. Hi, James.
Hey, how you doing today?
Okay.
Say, I'm born and raised right here in northwest Montana, Flathead Lake, largest freshwater lake west of the Mississippi. And over 20 years ago, we were privately told by friends in Fish and Game to quit eating anything over a 10-pound lake trout out of that pristine freshwater lake because it was too heavily poisoned by your heavy metal toxins. And that's out of the largest freshwater lake west of Mississippi. So a lot of the time in Alaska, something that a lot of people don't know is the fishing boats, the computer technology actually takes over the boat and tracks down the whole school of fish, so it cannot absolutely get away at all. And so instead of the net just swinging through a portion of the school, it takes almost the whole school when it finds one. King salmon, the Chinook, the last time that I think I heard of one over 90 pounds being caught sports fishing in out of the Kenai River was back in the late 80s when I first got to Alaska, and I don't think they've got one since. And the something I didn't know until a little while ago, the original ocean was saline. Kept at a saline point by the fresh water that dissipates over the earth and collects the minerals that leach back into the ocean. Well, that's your main problem against the oceans coming back, in my mind, is because we are completely oversaturated in pollution, and you know we can't clean up the oceans when our complete earth is saturated in poisons.
James, that's a great call. That is a great call. Rick, your comments.
I totally agree with it. We have not been playing very well with our world. We have been putting away our toys. We have to learn how to close and work with the with our environment, our ecosystem, and what I'm talking about is easing off of things that are being where the alarms are going off, you know, and what I'm talking about in this particular discussion are the things in the avoid category, you know, the monkfish, the orange roughies, the sharks, you know, the certain species of swordfish and groupers, and you know, Chilean sea bass, and you know, and it's not so difficult to find something that's delicious to replace it as well. Now, in the interim, we need to stop putting toxins into the ocean. I mean, there was a mentality where we thought we could dump whatever we wanted into it. It was endless, and we could take whatever we wanted. Well, that selfish attitude is coming to a moment where we realize that can't happen anymore, and we have to be a little bit more sensitive to how we're working. So I think that's the topic of discussion.
This lake that James was talking about, obviously, that's not there's no rivers of pollution floating into that. If he's talking about mercury and heavy metals, that's coming from air pollution. That's burning coal and things of that sort that end up in a lake and then in fish, right?
From my perspective, that's true. I don't know if that's the case in this particular lake.
Okay. Wildcard line, Richard in Los Angeles. Good morning, Richard.
Yes, gentlemen. Thank you for the topic. I really appreciate it. I grew up in the Florida Keys, where Rick said he's in Key West. I was wondering if he had a chance to get the Bimini before the Complete Angler burnt down with all the pictures of Hemingway, with all the bluefin that they caught back then.
Yeah, I've seen those. I've seen those images. They were amazing.
Yeah. And my point is that they are strip mining the ocean. They are raping our mother ocean, and I really don't see anything that's going to stop them. This conversation is beautiful about that, but I don't see the Japanese and the Mexicans and you know, with the sailfish and the long lines and everything. We can control our coast, but we cannot control our migration about that.
Thanks, Richard. It's a good point. Rick, are you hopeful? I mean, you know, maybe Americans can get it together. Coast to coast listeners put a pressure on our government to protect the coastlines as they do up in Alaska. We do a lot of stuff here, but what about the rest of the world?
I don't know if the rest of the world is ready to listen to this, but they're not going to have much of a choice. They're going to start watching the lights getting turned off one by one. And, you know, and the end of the line really clearly stated that the bluefin tuna scenario is a that they want They want the collapse. They want the extinction of the species because they're sitting on hundreds of tons, hundreds of thousands of tons of frozen bluefin tuna that they can just then name their own price. I mean, then you can't do that. You know, you're talking about Mother Earth, Mother Ocean. Yeah, I mean, because come on, everything that happens on land starts and originates in the ocean. It's in our, and it's a commonality between us and the entire world. So we all feel a privilege to be able to go out there. I don't have an answer. Am I hopeful? Yeah, I'm hopeful. I have to be. You know, I've been talking about it for 20 years. I'm living and seeing and watching a time in my life where people are starting to get it. I'm very excited by that. The very fact that we're discussing it on this program right now is testimony to the fact that it's being recognized as a serious problem and something needs to be done about it. What is that answer? How are we going to police our oceans? How are we going to play nicely in this large sandbox that we all share? I'm not sure of that. But it's got to start somewhere, and here's where it starts, the discussion, you know, and unification of a mindset.
There are some marine preserves that have been set up around the planet, sort of sanctuaries for fish where fishermen can't go in, and they've had some pretty good results. But as that caller mentioned, Richard calling from L.A., you know, fish move. They don't stay in one place.
Yes, the pelagic species, the large migratory species, 90% overfished right now. That's the problem. And like I've been preaching the whole time, is every single species is important to the success of an ecosystem.
Well, is there such a thing as like taking bluefin tuna and putting them in a sanctuary and putting nets around them and protecting them and letting them multiply?
I would hope that that's a solution. I hope that would work. I don't know how well they would do it. It would have to be a very large area. These fish can accelerate faster than a rocket ship. I mean, they're just giant muscles of the ocean. That's why they're so majestic. That's why they're so respected. They're so hunted. They're just amazing creatures. Can you stick them in a pen and have success? I hope so.
What's the price? Now, I think you mentioned something that sounded outrageous to me, but if you were, and I know you wouldn't, but if you were to go out looking for bluefin tuna tomorrow, what would you pay for a pound or 10 pounds or something like that?
10 pounds, $1,000. I mean, it's getting to the point now because it's so sought after. It's upwards around $100 a pound for certain cuts and pieces and parts. I mean, everything has a fat content, and the more fat, it equivalents to a higher tariff.
But it's at the point where it doesn't really make sense. Some people are just paying it to look fabulous and important.
Absolutely. Just so that they can be eating bluefin tuna and then. I don't understand. I do understand the texture of it. I understand the flavor of it, the umami of it. I get it. But is it worth it to bring it to extinction? Absolutely not.
You know, we're talking about you being hopeful. You've been on Oprah and the Today Show preaching these same kinds of things. What's the general attitude of mainstream media about this issue?
I've seen it go from curiosity to concern. I don't think it's still really embraced, and I don't think it's taken as seriously yet as it needs to be.
Okay.
With the exposure of the end of the line, that's going to help change.
We're talking with Chef Rick Moonen, author of Fish Without a Doubt, and we'll be coming back with more of your questions right after this on Coast to Coast AM. It's all connected. You know, you wipe out one fish species, sharks, tuna, and it affects other species and then on down the food chain and until at some level it affects us. We're talking with Chef Rick Moonen, author of a book called Fish Without a Doubt, about the health of our oceans or lack thereof. When we come back, we'll get to as many of your calls as we can get to. Stay with us. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast. We've got about 20 minutes left with our guest, Chef Rick Moonen, going to the phones. East of the Rockies, Eugene in Deer Park, Texas. How you doing, Eugene?
I'm doing great. Hey, Mr. Moonen, this is a very important presentation you're giving tonight, so way to go.
Thanks.
Listen, it sounds like China and Japan and some of those other countries are doing some really outrageous stuff, but I think maybe we need to think about getting a beam out of our own eye before we see about helping them get the splinter out of theirs. I read something the other day, and hope you can help tell me if it's true or not. You know, we've got these big old monster factory ships down there in the South Ocean scooping up megatons of krill and similar stuff, and then they they grind it up and dry it and package it and sell it as protein supplements for farm animals. And the end result, according to this article I read, said that the pig is now the single largest ocean predator. You know, if you had a PLT for lunch and you're helping out with the, you're making the problem worse without even knowing it because of our own sustainable agricultural techniques here on land. Is that true? That's my question.
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. You're just scaring the heck out of me, though. That's further tilting this the imbalance of ocean protein that we've been discussing all night. That's already in a critical state. So, awesome, way to go. That has to come to a screeching halt. And I agree with you 100%. We do have to get the beams out of our own eyes.
Eugene, that's a great question. I know that our earlier guest, Rupert Murray, sort of indicated that we're using a lot of fish meal and stuff from the ocean to feed not only fish but other animals. You haven't heard of this before, Rick, though, with pigs?
No, I never heard of that before, but I know that they use some there is some chicken going into fish meal in order to fish for aquaculture. You know, so I don't know what's right, what's wrong anymore. I mean, but the taking krill, a wild product, out of the ecosystem to feed pigs is just ludicrous.
Eugene, thank you for that call. West of the Rockies, Gene, here in our backyard, Henderson, Nevada. Hi, Gene.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. Great show. I really appreciate the subject. I'm a Bristol Bay fisherman in Alaska. Been doing it about 17 years. I just wanted to maybe correct Rick on one thing, that Bristol Bay has never been healthier. It's a very well-maintained, like he pointed out, highly policed fishery. And, in fact, some of the last few years have been some of its best years, dating back maybe 60, 80 years. So I didn't want anybody to get the idea that you shouldn't eat Bristol Bay salmon or sockeye salmon.
Well, I recommend that any wild species of salmon that you can purchase at the supermarket, that you should that's what I serve in my restaurant.
Fantastic. And
that's the only salmon that I eat. I do not eat any farm-raised Atlantic salmon. I refuse to eat it. And that's
okay.
A longer story.
But my point is, there's no scarcity. We just caught 30 million fish this last summer, and while the Fraser River might be missing fish, Bristol Bay had 6 million fish just arrive that no one predicted. So the point is, Bristol Bay fish is wonderful, great product, and people should be looking for it.
I agree with you 100%.
They need to make you their poster guy. Thanks, Gene. Thanks for the call. First-time caller, Randall in Columbia, South Carolina.
Hey, Rick. Appreciate you for your service. My family was into a seafood brokerage business in the mid-70s. Sold out to General Mills and had a couple of seafood restaurants. So I have a little bit of knowledge in seafood. But I greatly appreciate you talking about the adverse effects of what man has on God's works. And we see signs of that every day. Matter of fact, two big signs, and even one of folklore symbol, was that whale trying to beach itself off the coast of Florida. And I was wondering if you've done any study as far as solar effects on marine life, the negative effect of that, and if you heard about that old folklore about mermaids trying to lead us to safety. There was a sign or symbol or vision off the coast of Israel not too long ago, right after the whales trying to beach itself off the coast of Florida.
Wow, that's pretty wild stuff. I mean, it's just more. I don't know about the solar part. I do know that the pH of the ocean is changing, and that has a lot of detrimental effects. So there's a lot of things that are changing before our very eyes. So it can very well be a combination of many things, but we have to accept the fact that we've had our hand in it for a long time, and we need to get our hand out of it and try to help restore what happens naturally. Now, what happens with the sun and everything else, I know, obviously we don't have as much say over, but we do have a say over what we dump in the ocean and how we take it out.
Appreciate the call, Randall. Hey, Rick, one thing that I get confused in my mind is dolphins versus porpoises. Can you eat dolphins, right? Or some kinds of dolphins?
No. I'm glad you asked the question. There's a dolphin fish also known as mahi-mahi.
All right.
It's a bullnose dolphin, it's called. And it has no relation whatsoever to the porpoise or the mammal, the dolphin. And neither one of those are consumed on the market or offered on the marketplace, not in the United States, at least. I can't say that for other parts of the world.
Right. I remember you had told me before that mahi-mahi was in the dolphin family, but it's not the same. It's called a dolphin fish, but not the same as the mammal.
No genealogy relations whatsoever. No, it's a flatfish. Dolphin is a mammal, has to come up for air, has a blowhole in the top. It's a warm-blooded animal. Whereas the mahi-mahi, which means strong in Hawaii, in Hawaiian, it's a completely different fish. And actually, very sustainable. It reproduces at a very young age. So, and it's a voracious eater, and it grows very rapidly. So it's considered to be one of the, it's always placed in the green parts of the best choices in a lot of these lists.
Okay, so people should feel free to eat mahi-mahi guilt-free.
Exactly.
Will, right, wildcard line, Will in Madison, Wisconsin. Good morning, Will. Will, are you there?
And when I was young, I used to canoe with my friends in many parts of Canada. And we got lake trout, we got walleye, northern pike, big ones. Now, a couple summers ago, we went up in some of these places, and guess what? The fish are small because, I'm going to get to my main question, the Canadian government or something have given the First Nations people, and I hope the First Nations people will start to control their own people, the right to fish as much as they want using white man's instruments. And they're just overfishing and flying the fish down into America. But in any event, my question is this. When I was young, I used to be a herring choker. I used to fish herring off the herring boats on Lake Superior, the greatest herring lake in the world. And a big company, a taconite industry, ruined Lake Superior. The herring and the smelt are all gone. Now my question, is there a possibility that DuPont, 3M, it's been in the papers, Monsanto, some of these big industries are putting pollutants, and also these factory farms are putting pollutants into our bodies of water, rivers, lakes, and ruining them? And could they, for example, be affecting the Gulf of Mexico and other bodies of water around America and Canada and the world?
Simple answer, yes.
Yeah, Will, I think Rick has expressed this throughout the program. He does think that these things are happening. I don't know if he wants to go on air and identify particular companies, because we do have legal considerations. But, yeah, I think your suspicions are absolutely right.
There's no question about it. I mean, I grew up in New York, and we know that a large company dumping a lot of waste into the Hudson River created a lot of problems for the ecosystem. The teeming runs of shad and striped bass and an amazing amount of fish that would go up and down the Hudson became a big problem when General Electric was dumping a bunch of stuff into the Hudson River.
Thanks for the call, Will. Appreciate it. We're going to Rick in New Mexico. Good morning, Rick.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Okay.
I'm great.
Well, let me just say that I'm an ex-fisherman up in Alaska, or from Alaska, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally believe that it's almost like liberal ideas are the ones that are killing the fishing industry. First off, when I first started in the fishing industry, they enacted a new rule that said you had to keep, or you could only target certain fish, and you had to throw everything overboard. We threw more overboard than we kept.
Yep.
And we could have kept so much. And, it, you know, like you were talking about black cod, we would target a specific area where there was black cod and there was also turbot. But we were only allowed to keep the black cod if we targeted black cod.
So you had to throw turbo over the side of a boat?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That's unbelievable. Turbo is worth so much more than the black cod could ever be. And because you were targeting black cod, Turbo got thrown overboard, dead or dying, probably, I would assume, by the time.
It was dead. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I mean, it was great for us because we got to see the killer whales. They love turbot. So they came up on the side of the ship and just ate all the turbot. But,
I can hear in the tone of your voice that that reward was not worth it.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that worth it. But at the same time, you know, like the next day we say, well, you know what? Because we didn't call them counters up at the time. We called them observers.
And hey, Rick, I'm wondering this. You started this by saying it's the liberal people that were doing this. What year were the liberals in charge of Alaska?
Well, this started in 91.
And it was a liberal administration in Alaska that enacted this?
It started from the East Coast. The East Coast ideas came over to Alaska, and that's what started this. So now what I'm just saying is why couldn't we just keep everything on board? Because, you know, like I'm saying, the next day we would target turbot and throw the black cod overboard.
Oh, man. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That makes no sense at all.
That's exactly the way the whole Alaska fishing industry worked when I was up there. Instead of just keeping everything that you caught, I mean, we would catch, you know, I mean, there'd be certain parts where we would catch a rock sole and we'd throw over a halibut, you know?
And when you're throwing these over, when you throw them over, I mean, they die? They're dead?
Oh, they're dead. They were dead.
Man.
Yeah.
And that's the bycatch, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, the bycatch thing.
Well, that's just ridiculous. That is.
Oh, it is. It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we could have been staying at that place where we were catching black cod for 5 days and filled up the boat instead of sitting there fishing for 10 days and killing turbot one day and killing black cod the next day.
That's a great point. You know, we were talking in the first part of the program about this documentary, The End of the Line, and I think I'm trying to remember what the figure was. It was something like 7 billion pounds of fish worldwide are thrown away, including like turtles, dolphins, porpoises, all kinds of things.
Albatross, well, yeah, it's crazy.
Rick, very good point. Very good point. I appreciate the call. We're going to Tony in Washington. Good morning, Tony.
Yeah, George, I wanted to suggest a guest for you earlier. You've been talking about a lot of mercury air pollution from coal-fired power plants.
Right.
There's a guy who runs a company called PowerSat in Everett, Washington. His name is William Manis, and he is advocating solar power satellites and shutting down all the coal-fired power plants and putting rectennas over them that collect microwave energy from space. It might help clean up the mercury air pollution problem you're talking about. The other thing that I started thinking about was this new movie called The Cove that's talking about areas in Japan where illegal dolphin killing is being done. And then this is the question I had for your chef. Is there a substitute, is there a vegan substitute for a soup thickener for the shark fin soup? Is there... Or is there some other type of marine fish that can do it that is sustainable?
There's always substitutes. It's, you know, it's a matter of, I mean, there's kelp. There's seaweed substitutes. There's amazing gelatinous, derivatives that are not even, you know, protein derived. You know, they're from live ocean animals. You know, they're from plant life. Yeah, there's substitutes, but shark are still getting killed at an alarming rate just for the ceremonial shark fin soup.
Wonder if you could fake it in these restaurants. You know, serve them some kelp and get away with it. Since you know, people don't even know what shark fin tastes like.
I don't want to enter into that discussion.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Tony. Eric in Woodside, California, on the Wild Card Line. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. How are you, George?
All right.
I just, you know, I lived in Half Moon Bay, California for many years.
Delicious.
And used to fish as a kid in the creeks. And, you know, nowadays there's, I won't mention the name, but chains of supermarkets where people were taking the shopping carts and things and building dams in the creeks and keeping the steelhead and the salmon from running up them. And that was going on in the early 70s. I had a campaign in my local neighborhood where we went and got all the kids and everything and cleaned out the creeks to try to get the dams and things freed up so that the fish could actually run up and spawn and whatnot. As well as we used to fish off the breakwater and catch link cod, blue link cod. And I don't see any of those anymore. The fishing is terrible off the shore. I also used to have a commercial fishing boat, salmon boat, that was small and went through all the regulations of if you didn't catch enough fish one year and have sales and fish tags for what you sold, they wouldn't renew your license. I also went through the period of time where they shut the actual salmon runs down to us going out and getting them. And as a small independent business, trying to make a living off of a commercial fishing boat, a lot of us went out of business due to the fact that, they regulated the system as well as, a lot of other factors, maintenance on the boat and such. So I've been through all of that a lot. And my main question is about the Japanese. I've heard the Japanese are running these factory ships. They're whaling ships. They have three harpoon ships that travel with the mothership, which is the factory ship. Mm-hmm. And they have written in big English letters research on them. And I know Greenpeace and other organizations similar to them have been trying to get in the way and stop them because these big factory ships can't process the whale, haul it in through the back and just strip it and cut it up and everything while it's moving. So they keep trying to chase it and also, observe what's going on. And they won't send the harpoon boats, I guess, can't go out and kill the whales if there's witnesses. I'm wondering if you've heard anything about that and, why is that happening? Why can they use the word that they're doing research when actually these are big processing factory ships and they're got to be using the products, for sale or for consumption?
You're going to have to answer quickly because we're about out of time. Thanks for the call, Eric. Rick?
Wow. Well, I think what we're hearing here is there's an awful lot of things that are going on. There's just no tight regulations. I mean, there's too much that slips through the cracks. There's laws, there's quotas that are being totally blatantly disregarded. There just needs to be more policing. We need to put more of a emphasis on maintaining realistic quotas
all right
for the ocean going forward.
Chef Rick Moonen, thanks for joining us. Really enjoyed it. Hope people will check out your website, rmseafood.com, and take a look at your book, Fish Without a Doubt. Also, thanks to Rupert Murray, director of The End of the Line. I'll be back next Sunday night with our guest, Richard Dolan, one of our favorites from the UFO world, talking about his new book. Thanks, everyone. Good night.